there's a major typo in the title. So this is 2015, not 14, for you guys who are watching us on Peersa. You didn't pick up the wrong talk. Okay. So today I'm going to tell you about what my collaborators and I are doing in the field of shape dynamics, which is a new theory of classical and hopefully quantum gravity. And you can find more information about this in this tutorial, which I put on the archive. And it's going to be published in the next months. And there's also a bunch of upcoming works that you should keep an eye for on the archive. So let's get started. First of all, what are the problems that shape dynamics might help us with? So general relativity has several issues, both at the classical and the quantum level. What regards the classical theory, there is this property of not being a complete theory, let's say. The way Wheeler puts it is that it predicts its own demise in the form of singularities. So singularities are regions where there are many definitions, but a way people understand it is, for example, when you have curvature invariants that blow up and you cannot remove these properties with a coordinate change. A singularity is a region of space-time where you cannot really predict anymore what the how physics will behave. For example, geodesics cannot be continued past singularities. Someone said that anything could come out of singularities, as is illustrated by the movie Interstellar, which I won't tell you about because it would be a big spoiler. But yeah, literally, we don't know what happens there. So it could be seen as a flaw of the theory, and maybe we might want to find a way to remove this or explain this. To give you two examples, in a black hole, in a static eternal black hole, which is described by this space-time line element, you have this scalar, the Schwarzschild scalar, this curvature invariant, which blows up like r to the 6. So at the origin, it diverges, and that can't be removed by any coordinate change. And another important example is cosmological singularities. So this is an ansatz, an FRW ansatz for the form metric, and there is a scale factor. And you can see that the Ricci scalar here goes like that. And depending on your cosmological model, you might have a singularity here in the Ricci scalar. So for example, in Kasner epochs, you have a scalar factor that goes like a power law. And then you can see that at t equals 0, the thing will blow up. So so far, I would say that most people expect these things to be features of the theory. They have been explored a lot, and they are robust. And probably only quantum gravity will help us solving this problem, as it did, for example, in the case of the self-energy of an electric charge in the Maxwell system. This is the common expectation. But shape dynamics offers an alternative to that, which is purely classical, so as I'll show you. The quantum level, GR, as you probably all know, is not very happy with quantum mechanics. There are several things that don't fit together. One of these is space-time diffeomorphisms, or general covariance. It's problematic, in particular, regarding time-like diffeomorphisms, which are related to the ability of, to change the way you divide space and time, the way you foliate your space-time manifold. This is a symmetry that is generated by this thing. In gauge theory, symmetries are related to constraints, so redundancies in your description. And this thing, called the Hamiltonian constraint, is associated to these refoliations. It is problematic per se because it's quadratic in the momenta, which are conjugate to the metric. And Therefore, you cannot interpret it as a geometrical transformation on a configuration space, because the gauge constraints we are used to, like the Gauss constraint of Young-Mills, or the three-dimensional diffeomorphism constraint of general relativity, they are linear in momenta. Therefore, it can be understood as vector fields that move you on a configuration space. This is not the case here, so it's not clear how to quantize that and how to even interpret it. Moreover, these refoliations, so changing your hypersurface of simultaneity, they cannot be distinguished from dynamics, from time evolution at a local level, because locally you're really moving forward or backwards your time slice. Therefore, they coincide with evolving your physical state. Therefore, they intertwine really a gauge symmetry, because the constraint is also responsible for gravity to have two local degrees of freedom, two physical propagating degrees of freedom instead of three. And that is a property of a gauge constraint. So it intertwines gauge and time evolution. So what can we do about that? Dropping the constraint is not a, a great idea, because, as I said, it's responsible for the fact that gravity has two degrees of freedom. So gravitational waves have two polarizations. So dropping it will give you a new scalar degree of freedom, which you don't know what to do with. What shape dynamics does is not to drop it altogether, but trade it for another constraint, which is more tractable. It's, it can be interpreted as a vector field on a configuration space, and it has a clear geometrical interpretation. It's that of a generator of conformal transformations, as I will show you. And the resulting theory has two degrees of freedom, and at the local level is equivalent to GR. And I will make this more precise in which sense. So, what is the starting point? We don't trade one symmetry for another at random. There is a very good reason why we choose that particular new symmetry. And the reason is that we take seriously a message from the 60s or the 70s coming from people who studied the initial value problem of general relativity. I would argue that these people ended up showing that one can understand gravity as a theory of conformal invariant degrees of freedom. So the story, in the short version of the story, is the following. In the 60s, as you may know, Arnoit, Deser, and Misner formulated GR as a Hamiltonian theory. So they split space and time in a random fashion, and then they switched from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian description through a Lagrange transformation. And you see that the four-dimensional metric splits into a three-dimensional metric on your spatial slice and a bunch of other fields, which turn out to be Lagrange multiplier in the action. They don't appear with time derivatives, so they're not physical. They're associated to constraints. And these constraints are associated to gauge symmetry. So three constraints are the so-called diffeomorphism constraint, associated to changes in your coordinate system in the hypersurface of simultaneity, and this famous Hamiltonian constraint. Now, to find a solution of the theory, and to even define the initial value problem, so which initial metric and metric momentum can you you can choose for in order to have a solution of the theory, you need to find a metric and a momentum that satisfy these two constraints. And this is a hard mathematical problem that has been solved in the 70s, but the story of the solution traces back to Liknerovich in the 50s, actually. They found out that playing with conformal transformations, they were able to transform these two hard constraints to solve into two elliptic differential equations, which have good existence and uniqueness properties of their solution. And the way they did it was to take this particular slicing. This is a choice of foliation, a way to split space and time. So the trace of your momentum, which is associated to the trace of the extrinsic curvature of your spatial manifold, and essentially is the momentum conjugate to the local volume element, so to volumes. That thing has to be a constant in space. So of course it is a density, so there is this volume form here, but tau is the same value everywhere. So space essentially has to expand at the same rate everywhere. Within that foliation, they were able to transform this system into a much more tractable system. And these two equations, elliptic equations, the system transforms into, are covariant under conformal transformations, which are these things. When you you change the metric into the same metric times a function, a local function, which moves, it blows up or shrinks the local volumes. They're called conformal or wild transformations. So, therefore, to find a set of initial data, all you have to do is to choose a conformal geometry, so an equivalence class of three-dimensional geometries under diffeomorphism and conformal transformations. And also, you need a velocity, a momentum associated to that. And the role of this momentum conjugates to conformal geometries is played by TT tensors. So tensors that are that solve the diffeomorphism constraint, so are transverse, and they have a zero trace. So they solve this other constraint, which generates conformal transformations. Anyway, to make a long story short, the message from the 70s is that conformal geometries and TT tensors are the physical degrees of freedom of general relativity, according to these people. Because a choice of this and this will generate all possible solutions that are compatible with an initial, with a Cauchy problem on this kind of slice. Now, these CMC slices have several interesting properties that make it a quite exceptional choice of foliation in GR. There is a large literature on the properties of the slicings. The one that interests me the most is the fact that they seem to tend to avoid singularities. They pack up around singularities and never cross the region where the singularity is. This depends on your notion of singularity, of course, but the strongest argument I found was in this paper where they say that for all physically relevant singularities, according to Tipler, there are one particular kind that is also compatible with the cosmic censorship hypothesis. These things slicing would avoid the singularity always. So you can prove it for that class of singularities. This is for what is called maximal slicing, which is the sister of the CMC foliation when the space is asymptotically flat, when it's non-compact. why? Because the difference is that the trace of your momentum now is zero. It is a constant, but the constant is zero. In the compact case, this thing corresponds to CMC. And in this case, you cannot avoid all singularities. There are a kind of singularity called crushing singularity, where the volume element goes to zero everywhere simultaneously. Those are not avoided by this kind of foliations, but the rest is still avoided. So, well, I'll tell you that this is one of the things that we would like to make more precise in shape dynamics, to study singularity theorems that are well studied in GR and generalize them to shape dynamics. Anyway, so what is shape dynamics? It's the idea of taking seriously this foliation and imagining that it's fundamental, that the theory lives on that with that particular notion of time and space, and that quantum mechanics, for example, exists, is defined on that particular slicing, so taking seriously this idea led people to define a different theory of your spatial geometry, which is based on conformal geometries, not on Riemannian geometries. So the way we define it today is through what is called a linking theory. So this is a technical tool, essentially. You can you start with the phase space of general relativity, which is the metric and conjugate momenta. You enlarge it with a scalar field, an auxiliary field, and you introduce all the constraints of general relativity, so spatial diffusions and refoliations, plus this a new constraint which implements this conformal invariant. So you have everything there. Then you have two gauge fixings. One is the one that reproduces GR because it kills this conformal invariance constraint and it gives you the constraints of general relativity. And the other is the conjugate, basically, gauge fixing, the one in which the conjugate momentum 2 phi is put to zero. This kills the Hamiltonian constraint and leaves you with the conformal constraint. Therefore, you have a theory of three-dimensional conformal geometries and invariant under diffeomorphisms as well. Then these two theories admit each one a gauge, which leads to the same theory, which is essentially either general relativity in that CMC foliation, in that special foliation, or shape dynamics in a particular conformal gauge, which means with a preferred notion of volume, of local volumes, which is uniquely defined. And this is where you recover the equivalence with GR and you can translate from one theory to the other. So what do we do with the, so you will have got the message by now that the local volume degrees of freedom, like the determinant of the spatial metrics, have a different role in shape dynamics. So shape dynamics reshuffles this degree of freedom in the following way. The square root of G, as I told you, are the local volumes. The momentum that is conjugate to that, essentially, there's a caveat here, is the trace of P, that conformal constraint I talked about. And shape dynamics takes the local part of these two, so the local volume element divided by the total volume of the universe if it is compact, and the fluctuations of the trace of P around its average value. These two are just pure gauge. They can be freely chosen. The global parts of these two guys, which are the total volume of a compact universe and the average of the spatial average of the dilatational momentum of the trace of P, will play the role of an Hamiltonian and a time. Because this will be a monotonic variable, and this this on-shell volume will evolve, will be the generator of translations in this variable here. So you repackage these conformal degrees of freedom in this way. Practically, what you do to find this Hamiltonian is that you have to solve this elliptic equation, the same that Liknerevovich and York found, and you plug the result back into the equation for the total volume. And this is your generator of dynamics. Yes. Yeah, so, yes. The honest answer is yes, but most of the things we've done is in an asymptotically flat case, and this will be part of my talk. I will explain you in which sense we understand asymptotically flat in shape dynamics. It's a small region of a space-time, or a space, which is essentially empty, and at the center you study how matter evolves. Then this is well approximated by asymptotically flat. And of course, you're not sensitive to the evolution of this York time, which is a universal thing. So you can keep it zero and ignore its change over the time scales you're interested in. So I will talk about that. This is just a picture that I'd like to show. And it illustrates the two constraints, the conformal constraint of shape dynamics and the refoliation constraint of GR. And they are transverse because they gauge fix each other. In the intersection, you have that common theory that the two theories are, in a gauge, the two theories reduce to. And then there's this flow, which is the evolution generated by that global Hamiltonian that is left over that I talked about. Anyway, so these two theories are gauge equivalent. One expects that there will be differences at the quantum level because one interprets the conformal constraint as the gauge constraint and the other as a gauge fixing. So that is expected, but are the differences only at the quantum level? We think that the answer is no, because at the classical level, there is the fact that they have a common gauge isn't the end of the story. To have a solution of one or the other theory, one also makes some requirements. In GR, one of the postulates of the theory is the existence of a four-dimensional manifold, a Lorentzian manifold that we call space-time. And it has to be smooth, at least outside of singularities. Modulo singularities, you require that your space-time metric is smooth or even analytic. It depends on the context. But anyway, you don't expect it to do anything dramatic modulo singularities. In shape dynamics, you do a different thing. You require the smoothness of the conformal equivalence class of three-dimensional geometries, so it's different. And this means that if you make the same assumptions, for example, some initial data, some matter configuration, some gravity waves, and some symmetry requirement like spherical symmetry, then you get a different, inequivalent physical situation. So I will show you now a precise example of this. And it is in the simplest solution of the theory you can imagine. It's a asymptotically flat, spherically symmetric, stationary solution in empty space. In GR, the solution is Schwarzschild's geometry with all these perks. You know that it has a singularity and an horizon, etc. In shape dynamics, so the solution is a three-dimensional geometry that does something, that evolves, whatever. Then there is a sense in which you can construct an effective space-time out of it, which is what your matter will experience when propagating on this background. And this will be part of my talk, convincing you that this makes sense, that there is a precise way to do this. And if you reconstruct a four-dimensional line element, this is what you get. It's still Schwarzschild, but in isotropic coordinates. These coordinates don't cover the whole of Schwarzschild, only the exterior, and they cover it twice. So what happens here is that your four-dimensional geometry is degenerate at the horizon. The determinant of g mu nu is zero. And it's really not smooth. If you write down the Reich-Auduri equation, which studies how parallel geodesics converge or diverge, you will have a jump in the expansion scalar. From a negative value will jump to a positive value discontinuously at the horizon. So the four-dimensional connection is not continuous, and you don't have a four-dimensional manifold in the vicinity of the horizon. You have two, glued in a certain way. But the three-dimensional geometry is perfectly smooth, so it doesn't care about that. It's a property of the space, the effective space-time you constructed out of the shape dynamics solution. And it has a very interesting property. It is essentially two Schwarzschild exteriors glued at the horizon. So the point that we indicate with the origin here is like a point at infinity. You take an infinite proper time to reach it from any point within the horizon. So it's not really, yes?
Is this
the same geometry? Yeah, well, you can use those techniques because it's the Kruskal extension has four quadrants, and Schwarzschild, when you analytically extend it, has these four quadrants. So I have a slide here, but I showed you the Mona Lisa, too bad. Anyway, you have four quadrants. In shape dynamics, you excise these two quadrants, you invert the arrow time here, basically, and you glue it like this. So it's not a continuous space, it's two space-times glued together in some way. Okay, so, okay. This is to illustrate this other property that this metric has, which is an inversion symmetry. This is the metric here is invariant under this discrete isometry. R goes to the horizon squared over R. So you associate to each point inside the horizon one and only one point outside. The horizon is invariant, so a point close to the horizon, like the eye of Mona Lisa, will be matched to another point close to the horizon outside. And the origin will be matched to the point at infinity. So this this should convince you that it takes an infinite time, a proper time to reach the origin. And okay, so see, this is an embedding diagram which should illustrate this thing that you have two Schwarzschild exteriors glued together. So it's a wormhole, but and it's not a solution of Einstein's equations, because to make it stable, you need to put a sort of exotic matter on the horizon, because you know that you have this continuity. So you could have obtained this as a solution of Einstein's equations if you put a source for it, so an energy momentum tensor, which has a support, is supported over the horizon, so it's proportional to a delta function on the horizon. And so yeah, now this is the Kruskal diagram for this thing. And it has this unpleasant property that if you go through the horizon, you end up in this other region, and then you can go through the horizon again and pop out of this past horizon here. So you can have closed time-like curves, which is not the happiest situation in the universe. But this is nothing that we should be worried about, because it's really due to the presence of this past horizons that are not physical. You have the same situation in Schwarzschild, actually. Well, not those time-like curves, but you have a past horizon. You have this exterior diamond in Schwarzschild. What happens if I take a clump of matter and I drop it into the horizon? It will cross the horizon and go into the other region. But Schwarzschild is a time reversal symmetric. It's a static metric. So I can evolve the same geodesic backwards in time. And I will see again the same thing falling down the falling through the horizon, but now backwards in time. It would be like a ballistic trajectory of a projectile that goes up and then down. But this is not physical. The reason is that Schwarzschild's space-time is not really, does not model well a black hole because it's eternal. A real black hole will be created by some collapse of matter. And if you go backwards in time, you won't find another horizon, you will find your collapsing matter before it created an horizon. So this caps off this region here and prevents you from going through another horizon in your past. And in this case of shape dynamics, collapsing matter will do something like that. I don't know what happened. So this is the outside diamond. And this line here would be some matter that by gravitational collapse will create the horizon. And you see here, this double line is the origin, r equals zero. This is a flat region inside the shell of matter. And you see, you have no past horizon here. You have nothing to go through. And if this thing is symmetric under the same inversion and time inversion symmetry of the empty solution without collapsing matter, on the other diamond, I will have this situation in which, again, I have no future horizon to cross and to go back into the original region. So the arrow time here is inverted because, you know, it's not a continuous space-time. I have to patch together some continuous patches in some way to describe it through a Penrose diagram. I could imagine to flip over this part of the diagram and glue it to the other one and this would be the prescription. It's a bit funny. You have this sort of swapping between interior and exterior, which should correspond to that symmetry under inversion that you have in the empty solution. Yes? Sorry? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think there will be an inversion when you cross the horizon, and you might. Yeah, no. I don't know. The correct answer is I don't know, but I think that one can imagine that there is this inversion symmetry. The shell, the star, whatever, will create an horizon, and you will follow it after, you know, the matter. And the thing is now, what is in falling is outgoing. And if it has to do it with continuity, you shouldn't really see a bounce or something dramatic. So maybe you will find yourself in the interior of this spherical clump of matter, and the thing will be expanding around you. But anyway, it's too early to talk about this because we are doing it with an exact analytic solution. Now we're trying to face the problem and see what happens, because if it's not correct to just to take that background, that isotropic line element, and put matter on it without back reaction. Back reaction will be responsible for the creation or not of an horizon, so you should solve the exact equations. But with spherical symmetry, you can. You take a spherical infinitely thin shell of matter, pressureless dust is the simplest thing, and you make it collapse. Symmetry helps you a lot, and I don't know, we solved all the local equations, the constraints and the equations of motion, and we found nice and exact solutions. Then you can reduce this infinite dimensional system to a finite dimensional one, because you reduce the phase space to only the two Hamiltonian degrees of freedom of the matter of the shell. They are, for example, the area of the shell of matter and the conjugate momentum, which is the radial momentum of this matter. And then you have an Hamiltonian that evolves these two. But that's where we got. So the next question is, the Hamiltonian, of course, we cannot find exact solutions of that too. That would have been too nice. So we will have to do some simulations and check out what happens, whether the thing creates an horizon or freezes before creating an horizon. That's not clear at this point. There are foliations in which thin shells do create an horizon in a finite coordinate time. This, I don't know. And so depending on what it does, you will have a picture of this pocket universe or baby universe that is expanding, that has been created by collapse, or a frozen star that never really gets to create an horizon. I don't know at the moment. Okay, if you have any question on that, otherwise, yes. Yeah, and well, they will do, and they will end up here, I think, yes. Yeah, at Tweedle. Yeah, because, okay, this is the thing. If you take this diagram, you're taking the empty space solution, and then if you draw CMC slicing on that, you're drawing what notion of simultaneity matter would have ignoring back reaction. Ignoring back reaction, it takes an infinite CMC time to reach the horizon and actually cross. So yeah, they pack up here and they never actually cross. But then the common GR wisdom is that if you're on a geodesic in a finite proper time, you will end up crossing the horizon. So these diagrams have been drawn in the case of wormholes, and that's what is expected to happen. Now, for what happens in CMC time depends on back reaction. Now, whether the thing actually glues or they don't, and they never continue past this point. I don't know at this moment. Okay. All right, so let's move forward. Yeah, this is another case in which so this is an utterly unphysical model, but, or I don't know, maybe yes, but it illustrates how the other kind of singularities may be solved by shape dynamics. It's a symmetry reduced model, so a Bianchi one universe, in which you have the topology of a torus. If you do in 2+1 dimensions, you have that only a finite number of so-called Tech-Muller parameters are physical degrees of freedom. They are shapes, they represent the shapes of the torus, and the rest is pure gauge. In the 3+1 dimensional case, you have a bunch of Tech-Muller parameters, but also an infinite amount of local degrees of freedom on top of that. But the basic behavior is the same, is that you can write your CMC Hamiltonian in a way that through a reparametrization, completely does without the York time. And it looks like the Hamiltonian that generates geodesics on some two-dimensional, in this case, geometry. And So these UD6 can be continued forever unless they hit the boundary of Techmuller space. The boundary of Techmuller space is when the universe, the shape of the universe is singular. So you have like a pancake or a cigar when one of the dimensions is infinite and the others are zero, essentially. And these are genuine shape dynamical singularities. If the universe does that, that's a singularity in shape dynamics, because some of the shape degrees of freedom blow up. But the other singularity that I showed you at the beginning, the one regarding the Big Bang, the crunching singularity, is not, because it has to do with the non-conformal invariant degrees of freedom. Here, you have a situation in which if you construct your space-time, effective space-time line element out of your shape dynamic solution, you will have a lapse and a conformal factor that may blow up. And in particular, the conformal factor can go to zero anywhere on your curve. But then you're able to continue past that in Techmuller space. So the message is shape evolution doesn't care if there is a singularity in the volume, because the volume is just a gauge degree of freedom for it. You can propagate past it. Now, the interesting question is, can we do that for a more physical model of the universe? Can we continue past the crushing singularity at the beginning by demanding continuity of the shape, degrees of freedom? I don't know, but this model is just a toy model that illustrates how this could happen. And also this other interesting property of admitting shape singularities, which is not obvious. Okay. So now I showed you a space timeline element before in relation to this wormhole solution of shape dynamics. So we still tend to describe things in terms of space times. And there is a precise reason why we do this. Well, of course, it's because we're all used to it and it's what we understand. But I mean, physically, I think we now understand what is going on with this. When I show you a four-dimensional line element, I show you also a lapse. So this zero, zero components of the metric. That is obtained by solving a particular equation, which is called the CMC lapse fixing equation. And it is what gives you the equivalence between GR and shape dynamics. It's the gauge in which GR is equivalent to shape dynamics. So what is, the question is, if imagine that shape dynamics was the ultimate truth and everything happened on conformal superspace, on conformal invariant degrees of freedom, what does that lapse mean? Work that has been going on in the last months have shown what is the meaning of that. So a solution of shape dynamics, I said, is an evolving conformal three-dimensional geometry using York time as a the CMC time as a time parameter. So I said that you can reconstruct or construct a space-time from it by solving this LY equation, which gives you the gauge in which the conformal geometry is equivalent to GR. And also you need another equation to give you the zero, zero components of the metric. It's the lapse fixing equation. So the physical interpretation of that thing is that the space-time, this space-time is a sort of kinematical structure that is there, and it is what weak matter perturbations, when ignored back reaction, would perceive when they move on this shape dynamical background. So it shouldn't be taken literally as a God-given truth, because, for example, in that Kruskal diagram here, if you foliate it with CMC foliations, you see features like the things pack up here, et cetera. But these features don't have to be taken literally, because they only regard weakly back-reacting matter at first order in matter perturbations. There is a quotation that I like to take from Einstein. It was in 49. He was discussing the meaning of space-time and also the fact that the physical meaning of this four-dimensional metric that we have in space in GR. He was saying that the space-like and light-like distances that you can measure with this four-dimensional metric in GR are those ideally read by idealized clocks and rods, physical things. He was saying that the structure of the theory depends on two kinds of things. These measuring rods and clocks that give a physical meaning to the metric, plus all other things, so the fields, which we really think are the ultimate ontology behind the theory, electromagnetic field and the gravitational field. And this, he was saying, is inconsistent in some sense, because you would like these rods and clocks to emerge as solutions of your ultimate theory, not to be given as something that don't really, you can't really extract as a prediction from the theory. I have a tiny toy model, and a very nice one, which illustrates what I mean when I read, what I understand when I read that passage from Einstein. This is the n-body problem, so n-point particles interacting with a Newtonian potential. It's a good toy model of a closed universe. If you have no external frames, which means that the total angular momentum has to be zero, otherwise you would have a preferred direction, and no energy, because that would give you a preferred time scale. If the energy is zero and the angular momentum is zero, this is the kind of solutions you get. It's a universe that in the infinite past was infinitely large, then it collapses to a clump of matter, which is very homogeneous and chaotically moving, and then bounces back and expands forever. While it expands in the infinite future and past, structure is created. Clusters, subclusters, solar systems, and ultimately Kepler pairs, which are the most stable composite systems. These things, so here in the central state, you don't recognize any obvious candidate for a rod or a clock, because nothing is very stable. But here, in the future, you have something like this, or in the infinite past, you have these Kepler pairs, which are, they develop conserved quantities, like an angular momentum and a linear momentum and an energy. These are not conserved quantity for real, because only the total energy, angular momentum, and momentum of the system are conserved. But these are asymptotically conserved. So interaction with the rest of the universe make them fluctuate. But as time progresses, these fluctuations are damped and they go out. And in the end, you end up with very stable bound systems. And they have nice properties. They have a semi-major axis, which is conserved in size, in length, so it can be used as a measuring rod. You can compare the size of this measuring rod with another, and it stabilizes asymptotically. Their phase during their revolutions can be used as a clock. And again, these two clocks asymptotically will be isochronous, will march in step. And this is what you want from a clock. So this is, I think, what Einstein wanted when he asked for rods and clocks to be found as solutions of the theory. Yes? So you want to put a ruler, for example, some very, how would you do it? Because it has to be, okay, if it doesn't interact with the Newtonian potential, it's completely decoupled and it's not very physical. So you make it light, because the gravitational interactions are universal. So if you make it light, then it will be wildly, deformed by the rest of the matter. If you make it heavy, it will influence a lot the rest of the universe. So, yeah, it's tricky, but you see, this is what I mean. So, because gravity couples to everything. Okay, so if there are no other questions, this is ideally what we would like. It's easy with the n-body problem, but it's not easy in geometry dynamics at all. This is a first step, which Tim Kozlowski has been studying recently. He has a paper, an initial step on this direction. So here I will show you how precisely you get that matter fluctuations will experience this lapse, which is built as a solution of this elliptic equation. So you have a background solution of shape dynamics. So it's a conformal geometry evolving in CMC time. and you represented it in some gauge. So a three metric with the volume, but can be anything because you don't care about the volume part, its gauge, and a momentum. And then you add order square root of epsilon matter fluctuations with, for example, a scalar field, the kind of matter that has a quadratic Hamiltonian in the fields. So basically, what you end up doing is to add to your Lichnerowicz-York equation, which is the one that gives you the Hamiltonian of shape dynamics, the global Hamiltonian of shape dynamics, you add an order epsilon matter perturbations. The background solution has no matter, for example. And then you solve it at first order, so you write omega zero as the solution of the background equation, and omega one is the perturbation. Now, the York Hamiltonian, the generator of dynamics, will be this, omega to the sixth, so the on-shell volume, and you can expand it at first order in epsilon. Then the order zero term does not contain at all the matter degrees of freedom. So the matter degrees of freedom will be evolved by the order one term and further. And the order one term will look like this. The Hamiltonian of matter, so the quadratic thing in the fields, coupled to the background metric, times a particular lapse function, which is given by this equation. So here you write it as an integral kernel of that elliptic operator, but anyway, it is the solution of gauge condition for general relativity that gives you the equivalence with shape dynamics. The condition for being a foliation, a CMC foliation. So the matter fluctuations evolve according to this effective Hamiltonian at first order, and the equations of motion, the equations of motion at first order will be this, where this is the D'Alembert equation associated to the following four metric. A four metric which has a spatial component that is the conformally transformed background, so the solution of the Ly equation, and this lapsed solution of this other equation. So this is what I showed you when I showed you the wormhole line element. It's what, at first order, matter perturbations, weak fields will perceive, will experience. Now, the next challenge is to give you a precise prescription to measure these things, to actually perform experiments or idealized experiments with this, for example, scalar field, which allow you to reconstruct the difference in lapse between one point to the other, so the effective redshift and so on. And this is more complicated, and we're working on it. And interestingly, if you only have a massless field, I must say that you will only be able to reconstruct the conformal part of this four metric, because a conformal factor is insensitive to a massless field. You need mass for doing that. Anyway, this is an observation. Okay. From that, we have a prescription to describe, to generate an effective space-time on which matter will evolve. And now I will answer to the other question that has been posed regarding asymptotic flatness and Minkowski space in particular. What the theory, as I said, really only makes sense in the compact case, but we study it in the asymptotically flat case because we think it's an approximation to a small region of a very large universe which is filled with matter. And this region, it's small with respect to the whole universe, but it is empty, and it is much larger than a very small region of length small l, where stuff happens. An example is our solar system. The solar system is very small, and there is a big void between it and the nearest stars. Most of the mass is concentrated in the sun, like 99.9 something percent. And the characteristics have to be the following. You have small l, much smaller than large l. And you have to have the typical time scales of processes happening within small l that is less than the time light takes to cross the whole large l region, basically. With these requirements, you can approximate the situation with an asymptotically Euclidean space. So something that on L is essentially the Euclidean metric and zero momentum. And so this is what you do. Some people call it regions of finite infinity. So large L has to be, you make an expansion in orders in inverse, of inverse large L, and you study the first orders. What happens is that then your matter perturbations will be evolved by, through the York Hamiltonian, this thing that I, that is the dynamical, the generator of dynamics in shape dynamics. And it has the property that it is Diffeo invariant, three-dimensional Diffeo invariant, and conformal invariant. Now, on a background, there is a background, you can't be background independent anymore. So this infinitely dimensional redundancy is converted into a finite dimensional one. So you have invariance under the conformal isometries of your background metric. The Euclidean metric is invariant under this group of transformations. These are vector fields, so, and they generate isometries of the Euclidean metric up to a conformal factor. There are translations, of course, rotations, plus dilatations, rigid dilatations, and these funny conformal boosts or special conformal transformations, which twists the twist. They correspond to a skew transformation of the background metric, of the background coordinates. These are associated to conserved charges, which the Hamiltonian preserve. And the conserved charges can be written like this. This is the generator of the Diffeo constraints, of the Diffeo morphisms. And this is the trace of P, the generator of conformal transformations. This minus 2/3, this give you the generator of conformal, of volume preserving diffeomorphisms, also called incompressible diffeomorphisms. So if you plug a vector field in it, you get a diffeomorphism that doesn't change the volume element. And they are the generators of conformal isometries. You can calculate the Poisson algebra of these guys, and they reproduce the Lie algebra of the following group, SO41. So this is isomorphic to the group of conformal isometries of Euclidean space, so to the three-dimensional conformal group. So, and interestingly, you find that upon reparametrization of your notion of time, which has to do with a redshift factor, essentially, you have that D, the generator of dilatations, ends up being proportional to the Hamiltonian, to the time evolution generator. So from this, the idea would be to use this as a basis for quantizing matter perturbations on a shape dynamics background. You would have Tim has tried to write down a series of axioms for this quantum field theory, and it would be, instead of choosing irreducible representations of the Poincaré group, you use representations of this SO41 group, or algebra, really. And you can, and you have a quadratic Casimir, and if D is your generator of time translations, you can find out its spectrum and take the positive part, as you do for the generator of time translations in Minkowski. And the rest goes pretty much like the usual. It's just canonical quantization with these different axioms. And then the idea, which is not completely clear at this point, but the idea would be that you can reproduce the usual Poincaré invariant quantum field theory by taking what's called an Inono-Wigner contraction of SO41. So this is something that these guys studied. Inono won the Wigner medal, by the way, and worked with Wigner on this result. It's SO41 is really, it plays a double role. It is the conformal group in 3D, but it's also the group of isometries of the Sitter space-time. And so it's hyperbolic rotations in 5D, really. And the Sitter spacetime is an hyperboloid, in four-dimensional hyperboloid that can be embedded in 4D. And you reproduce the Poincaré group, the inhomogeneous Lorentz group, by essentially sending the cosmological constant to zero, or the radius of the hyperboloid to infinity. And the task now would be to understand what this means and what is this radius, because it's not clear whether it's related to the radius of your region of finite infinity or not. And yeah, so also the other thing would be to check whether this different formulation of quantum field theory gives you different physical predictions from the usual QFT on Minkowski, maybe not. And what is the control parameter of your perturbations from that? I don't know. This is work in progress yet, still. So, okay, I want to just mention, before concluding, this other work I'm thinking about. I have more slides on this, but I won't have time to go through them. If you want, I can show them later. I would like to formulate shape dynamics as a first order theory. This has been done for GR in many different ways, and there are connection formulations. There are basically the idea is that you describe everything with the Weier binds. So in this case, they would be dry binds. They are frame fields, so like the square root of the metric. That's what people like to say. The product of these two, these are vector valued one forms, and the symmetric tensor product of this, when you contract the interior index, gives you the metric. And why do you want to do that? It's because you want to couple fermions eventually, and fermions don't couple to the metric, they couple to frame fields or to a spin connection, actually. You want these, then you want them in shape dynamics, you would like them to transform through conformal transformations. Li has a proposal for this that has to do with quantum gravity and Nash-Tegar variables, and it's an interesting way to explore. He posted recently a paper on that. And Tim also has a paper on loop quantum gravity and shape dynamics. So I don't want to go there. What I think is that it's not only wild transformations that should be considered here, because the frame fields are vectors in the internal space. So they should make a difference between special conformal transformations, so conformal boosts, and wild transformations, which are just rescalings, because they have a vectorial nature. So you can't just consider, wild transformations, so rescalings, dilatations. You should consider the full SO41 group. And this is further motivated by Tim's proposal for QFT on an SD background. It's SO41 that's doing the job for us. So the framework I would like to, that I think is most promising for this is that of Cartan geometry, which essentially means that you have a manifold that is approximated not by its tangent space at a point, but by a homogeneous space, which can be curved, like a ball, for example, which is rolled over the manifold, and to give you depends on what you want, lengths or angles in the case of a conformal geometry, and SO41 would be the group that's behind this. You would have an SO41 bundle, and then you need a subgroup of this group that stabilizes, you say, the contact point between the model space and your manifold. I can give you more details on that, but the takeaway message is that SO41 has this particular structure that the subgroup you would want to use in order to model the whole thing is such that when you take the quotient to obtain your homogeneous space, which would be your ball that you roll over the manifold to describe its geometry, ends up being compact. So this is something that in other first-order formulations of gravity is not there. Maybe it's interesting in particular for quantization, I don't know. Anyway, this is just an observation. So I have more slides on that, but I think I will stop here. And well, to conclude, we are trying to do physics with shape dynamics, finally. We are getting the first solutions and studying them. We are learning how to make connection with the familiar space-time picture. And we are also, we have also an idea of how to study QFT on this background. And it would be very exciting if it gave something physically inequivalent, something new. Lots of open questions, of course. We are also studying the result of gravitational collapse, and that is close to completion as a project. After that, there will be the issue of seeing what happens to matter crossing the horizon. And more in general, if the shape dynamics completely does away with singularities or not. And if not, are these shape singularities possible, physical? Do they happen in some cosmologies? And what are their signature, if they exist? And of course, eventually we would like to attack quantum gravity itself, but this is a bit farther along the way. And I mentioned my first order proposal for a first order formalism. And there are, you have a very large connection in this formalism, and a lot of new fields that you need to do away with, you need to constrain away or keep, I don't know. You have a lot of space for new physics. That's the thing I want to remark, because the structure is complex, and it allows a lot of interesting explorations. Okay, this would be it for now, I guess. And thank you.
So, questions? Yeah, someone's calling in a question.
From home.
So, two questions, one shorter than the other. The first one is three dimensions special here? And the second one is, you had this conformally coupled scalar right at the beginning that you used to fix gauge. When you couple to matter and quantize, could that ruin that conformal symmetry? Could that scalar develop some potential quantum mechanically, and then, you know, either choose a gauge or ruin the whole thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Buzz was some ideas on the last thing, but I don't know. Okay, so let me answer to the second question first. We have a prescription to couple matter, and it is sort of a substitute of minimal coupling in GR, because the logic is the following. Matter fields in their preferred representation, so for example, if you have vector fields, they have to be one forms, actually. They will not transform under conformal transformations, so they will be invariant, but then they will fill this conformally coupled scalar through the metric. So you have to have, if you have a vector field, you have to make scalar products, and that will give you a coupling to the conformally coupled scalar. So this is a precise prescription, and it looks like, this is all at the classical level. It looks like it is really equivalent to minimal coupling, and all that the equivalence principle does for you. In this matter perturbation project, we are seeing something like that. That different fields will experience the same space-time, effective space-time, if they are coupled according to that prescription. That's the thing. Now, this said, there is the other part of the question, which is what happens with the scalar at the quantum level. And you want to add something to the? Yes. Yes, there is an issue with scalars. There is sort of a bound. If the scalar is massive, there is a bound that relates it to the cosmological constant, and which, when you violate it, you lose uniqueness of your of the solution of the LY equation. So you don't have a unique Hamiltonian. And I don't know, Rieger wrote a lot about that. It's not clear what the meaning is. would be nice if it was really a physical bound or something, but I don't know. And anyway, it's a bound on the density of the field times the mass, yes. Quantum mechanically, I don't know, why not? You have to study the path integral, you have to, the problem here is that you have to have a theory space and study the possible counter terms. And it's proving surprisingly hard to find plausible counter terms in these metric variables, because they have to be conformally invariant to be compatible with the basic symmetry. And it's surprisingly hard. The first order formalism might give us a lot of additional space for that, because you can write a lot of combinations of this larger theory space, terms in this theory space, and you have conformally invariant terms. So we'll see, I don't know. But it would be an interesting picture in which you break this scheme at a quantum level, and you get an effective potential for the thing, and it doesn't satisfy the constraint exactly the quantum level. You have corrections, and well, I don't know. What was the other question? Special? Yeah, well, I don't know. Where is it? The wild tensor is zero in three dimensions. The Cotton tensor is what describes conformal geometry. This is one special thing with 3D. I don't know. 3+1. Well. Yeah. Yes, in principle. At the moment, I don't see any obstruction. Here it could be, in the first order formalism, there is something special with it, I told you. Well, it's not even that. That is true even in the metric variables, that while tensor is completely trivial in 3D. So 3+1, I'm talking about a three-dimensional conformal geometry cross time. Then the wild tensor is identically zero, and you have to go one derivative above, and you have also an integrability condition to describe your conformal geometry. This is, I don't know what it means. It changes a lot the structure of this conformal Cartan geometry, but I have no intuition about the meaning of this. Anyway, yeah.
Next question. Did you?
Yeah. It's good not to have counter terms. Yeah. Well. yes. Yeah. Maybe it's good. I don't know. I still don't have enough intuition about the quantum theory, but okay, maybe it's telling us that you just don't have space for flowing anywhere. But of course, this is even without matter, so yeah, with matter, it would have.
The key point is that if it's hard to write counter terms, you have a chance to have a finite theory. I thought Dottie's point was that if you break the gauge invariance, anything, you lose the whole structure. So somehow the hope here is that the gauge invariance is preserved under quantization, even if usually we expect conformal anomalies in other approaches.
Yeah, so if that conformal symmetry is anomalous, then you gain a scalar, basically. So, well, and you know, there's the Ojava-Lifshitz literature on that's very large and shows what happens when you start to play with that. You have a lot of space then. Maybe. Yes?
No, I was just going to say that naively, of course, in three dimensions, it's conformal anomalies. You don't have the usual conformal anomalies. But this theory is a Hamiltonian theory, and to find anomalies, it's a bit more complicated than to usually find it just so the anomalies that you might get are not just the usual geometrical conformal anomalies as if you were looking at just a spatial manifold. You have to consider as well the evolution through the Hamiltonian, and that brings in the language and the geometric language of candidate anomalies and things like that. It brings in elements that might be of a higher ghost number and things like that. Those would represent anomalies.
You can play with the time derivative in addition to the
yes, derivative. And you get some specific candidate terms for anomalies in 3D. In 4D, you'd have more because then you have also the geometric anomalies at each surface.
Right.
And then there's maybe something that would make a difference in the dimension.
Yeah, but you see, it's tricky. It's not a four-dimensional CFT, which has anomalies because it's even dimensional. It's a three-dimensional CFT cross time. It's different. So, and you can't even interpret it as a three-dimensional Euclidean CFT because it's not. There is still an additional direction, which is your time. So I don't think we have the instruments have already been developed that much for this case. Yes?
So I guess I have one question and one comment. So question is, when you talk about contra terms, usually you talk about local quantum field theories and you write basically the local terms consistent with the symmetries. So I guess my understanding was that the Hamiltonian for shape dynamics is not local. Is that true?
Yeah, so.
So then what do
you
mean
by? Well, you recover a local description if you go to that CMC gauge, right? The gauge in which the equivalency is recovered. So then you don't have the non-local Hamiltonian. You would have it if you take a saddle point approximation to that. Now, from here, the directions are multiple. One would be maybe the first order variables, remove that because, you know, non-local things become local if you add fields and, you know, if you add degrees of freedom. And maybe that's where quantum mechanics really likes to...
But I mean, but I guess the thing is the rules of game has changed. Even if you go, okay, if you want to do shape dynamics, which is not a particular gauge, it could be any gauge in shape dynamics, then there is a question of why should we just restrict yourself to local terms? There's an infinite number of non-local ones. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And these will be neural functions.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So okay. Because of the Hamiltonian is non-local. Mm-hmm. If you restrict yourself to local, then there's
no. Okay. But probably the right thing to do is to include the non-local ones. Yeah.
And you need to find some solution of
So good. So that was my question. My comment is that the gravitational collapse in the CMC gauge is a very well-defined problem in GR, and nothing happens at the horizon. So why do you...
Nothing happens.
Nothing happens at the horizon.
So what? The thing cross, what happens?
Yeah, nothing special. Yeah, so. Right.
Okay, no, we are doing maximal slicing in asymptotically flat. That's
I mean, I think if it's asymptotically flat, it's there's some ambiguity about how to do it. But I mean, guess there is a way to do it that it crosses the horizon and
crosses and nothing happens.
And nothing happens. Nothing happens at the horizon, and so that's why I guess I've been saying this over and over, I think, over the years, and I guess I haven't really gotten a response, that there are obviously solutions in which weird things happen at the horizon, but the question is that the one that comes out of evolution? And, I mean, there is something that you can't do. It's Oppenheimer and Volkov collapse is the standard thing, and you could actually look at the CMT foliation of that, and that should be a solution to shape dynamics. Mm-hmm. And in that solution, I think nothing happens at the horizon. So if there are other weird things, other solutions in which something happened at the horizon, then I guess my guess would be that maybe those... Sorry, this is another question coming in. Yeah, sorry. Anyway, so that was just, I guess, my comment. I don't know if you want to.
Now I have a question for you, though. Well, how long does it? Then in the solutions, how long does it take in CMC time for the thing to cross? Does it cross in a finite
time? They cross in a finite time. So there is a universal horizon inside. So there is you never approach singularity. That's a 3/4 of the Schwarzschild radius. So you don't approach singularity, but horizon is not a special point in the solution.
Okay.
That's the way that I view it. I don't know if maybe Flavio has a different opinion. So what you're describing, and then you have specific boundary conditions that you need to impose for the finiteness of the charges that you get from shape dynamics. And those in the maximal slicing imply, at least not for the collapse. I agree with you that this needs to be done with that. But if you're going to do these types of collapse, you need to look really carefully whether you're going to use the maximum slicings or the basically CMC version of shape dynamics, and what do these things imply for the boundary conditions at infinity if you're going to use the but I think maximum slicing with the usual Reggie Teitelbaum boundary conditions, they cannot cross the horizon. The maximal. Yes. Yeah. I think so.
I mean, just to some extent, that discussion answered what I was going to ask about. But so, I was going to ask another way to ask Niyasha's question about how unique is the CMC slicing of a given space-time. Am I right that there's still a global Lorentz invariance in terms of how you slice it? Like there might be a unique CMC slicing of Schwarzschild where the slices are perpendicular to the time-like killing direction, but there's maybe a whole bunch of other CMC slices that just aren't static slicings. Is that right? And
okay, for
and then and kind of and do all those do all those CMC slicings cover the same patch of the space-time, or are there discrepancies between how much of the space-time they cover?
First of all, in Schwarzschild, again, we are talking about maximal slicing. So, but there's still a one-parameter family of those, I think.
I think there's probably still Lorentz invariance about, a global Lorentz invariance about which direction the slices tilt, any given slice.
Isn't it broken? Because in Schwarzschild, you have a location of the...
In Schwarzschild, there's a preferred one because you can choose it perpendicular to the time.
Okay, but you can boost it and you will see. Okay, in the sitter, for example, you see it very well. The CMC slicing are the compact spheres, but you can have you can boost that too, right? You have the global boost invariance, and that produces a whatever 3-parameter family of those foliations. So yeah. I don't know about Schwarzschild, though. I haven't looked into that yet. But yeah, in principle, you can have
I'd be curious to know
it
means.
This translates in the shape dynamics language in a different way, right? You have non-uniqueness of your solutions. That's what you see when you try to attack these problems which have global space-time isometries that are CMC-preserving. And I think that these are families of, there are different initial data that are, they transform into each other. So there are real symmetries of the theory as a dynamical system. So they map solutions into solutions, I think. I don't know.
Anything else? Strict conditions on the uniqueness of CMC foliations. Basically, if you have, for instance, a non-trivial I think it's the traceless part of the moment difference, then you have a unique solution of CMC. If there is a solution, if there is a foliation that is CMC, that is constant mean curvature, then that will be unique. And there's even stronger ones. I can give you some very strong conditions on the uniqueness of this. And it's degenerate in very, very symmetric cases only.
Okay, maybe let's thank Flavio again.
Thank you.